This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
Well, my name's Ralph Knowles, and I was born in Dunedin in 1944. Our household was a pretty typical North Dunedin household. In those days, it was a very residential neighbourhood, so that there were children in our house. I have three siblings, and another brother who died before I was born, which is another part of my story. But and neighbouring children all went to the same school. Very different now, because the University of Otago has bought every property I've had any contact with in Dunedin, and there are now university facilities on those sites. But a happy 50s childhood. I mean, I think now of Dunedin as being very cold and wet, but in my memory they were summer days, playing with George and Anne and Francis and Peter and other people in the neighbourhood. And I went to state primary and state secondary schools. Nothing very unusual there, although the primary school I was in was a model attached to the Dunedin Teachers College, and it was designed to give trainee students the opportunity to meet the sort of setup they would find if they were teaching in a country school, so that it was standard 1 to 4, and it was all people from one neighbourhood. So I had siblings and neighbours in my class at George Street Normal.
You mentioned about your brother passing away. What happened then?
He died at age 8 of a brain tumour in 1943. So that was in the war, and my father wasn't at home. He didn't leave New Zealand, but he was away in armed forces. Barry was obviously a bright and likeable boy. And the impact of his death was very, very strong on my mother, so that I was really in my 20s before we could risk openly referring to Barry. Not that Mum, you know, went hysterical or made a scene or anything, but you just knew that this was an area that that you should stay away from. And my aunt suggested to me once that I do the arithmetic of when I would have been conceived in relation to the first anniversary of Barry's death. I think it's quite likely that Dad was home on leave on that anniversary. So Barry died January 1943, Dad at home January 1944, Ralph's born in November 1944. My aunt raised that with me, just didn't make anything of it, but just suggested that I do the arithmetic. Who knows? I think to some extent I was the son who replaced Barry. And since in those early days the psychiatrists were always wanting to know what your relationship with your mother was like and whether your father was absent and all that sort of business, I can't help wondering if there was some significance to that.
Can you give me some examples as to why you thought that?
Now, it was really only once I started reading about homosexuality and the endless causes, you know, absent father, aloof father, dominant mother, all that stuff. In those days when they were really pushing the family relationships as a likely cause of homosexuality. And so I was reflecting on it and looking for anything that might have been different for me. I don't actually hold by it now, but I did think of it at the time.
So how would you describe yourself as a child?
happy, bit weedy, you know, inclined to bronchitis and asthma and things like that, but not clinically so. Intelligent, got on well with my schoolmates, got good results at school. socially confident. Some of those things faded as the years went by, but that's how I see myself. We've still got the minute book of the class meetings from about 1954 to 58. And, of course, my sister was also in the class, and I've already mentioned two neighbours. And, you know, Ralph Knowles said, and the chairman, Ralph Knowles, ruled, and all this sort of thing. You know, this was the teacher's attempt at introducing us to democracy or democratic processes. And it's really quite embarrassing to read that minute book now. But the Knowles family had a lot to say in those class meetings.
So can you paint for me a picture of what it was like just post-war 1950s Dunedin? How was it like growing up in that kind of environment?
I wasn't aware of missing out on anything, really. I mean, I knew that there were other parts of town where people were better off, but you know, some of the measures in the neighbourhood, not everyone had a car, but we did. Not everyone had a telephone, but we did. We had one of the larger properties in terms of area. Most of the houses nearby had two houses on a section the size of ours, so that we had a big front lawn. So we were often the centre of neighbourhood games and so forth. All sorts of things that are so different now. You know, there was a corner dairy. You walked a few blocks to the butcher. All in a pre-supermarket. I actually had a job as a delivery boy for the local dairy, and during that time, so I'm around age 12 by then, so what are we saying, mid-50s, he started the sort of mini-market. He started the serve-yourself. Until then, it had been a counter behind which you stood and served customers and so on. The church was nearby, All Saints Church. All Saints Church figured a lot in my early days there. I was born on All Saints Day, and my 21st birthday was the day that the parish turned 100. So it was all terribly, you know, significant. I'm not suggesting meant in any way, but it was just, you know, significant. I went to Sunday school there, joined the boys' choir before my voice changed. And after that, I became a server. That's one of the altar servers. We belonged to what was called the Guild of Servants of the Sanctuary and took it all terribly seriously. That led on to my sense of vocation to the Anglican priesthood. So, you know, my involvement in church activities, Sunday school, Bible class, choir, serving, and so on, was quite significant. Which was interesting. Mum was a reasonably dedicated Anglican. Dad was agnostic, if not atheist, and really didn't show much interest at all in our religious upbringing.
So what drew you to the church in the first place?
Look, really just that it was a bit like, you know, you went to school, you went to Sunday school. It was nothing more significant than that. But many people just have something in life that fascinates them. In the case of my partner, David, with whom I lived for many years, it was horse racing. He had a lot of other interests too, some more intellectual than horse racing. But and he and I used to joke about it, because my interest in religion and his interest in horse racing were much the same in terms of the practical impact. You know, if I saw an article in the paper about the church overseas or some theologian, I was fascinated by it. If he saw an article about some scandal in the horse racing industry, he was fascinated. And, you know, they both had a calendar, in the sense that there were the church calendar of events during the year, and the racing calendar was the same. There were rituals, church rituals, and, you know, the parading around the birdcage at a race meeting. Colours, Eucharistic vestments in purple and green and red and so on, and then jockeys' colours. And we joked about the fact horse racing wasn't really all that important to him, but he was fascinated by it and couldn't pass by any piece of information about horse racing. And I was a bit the same about religion. As an adult, it's meant more than that. But I'm not a fervent believer. I'm heavily involved, but I'm not actually a fervent believer, which is a strange little thing. But it's just any piece of news, any, you know, I now subscribe to several websites and online news services. I read them every day.
So back in 1950s Dunedin, what was your world made up of in terms of the diversity of people in your world?
North Dunedin in those days was white. I was going to add Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but that's not quite fair. There were Catholic families, but we didn't really have anything to do with them. They went to other schools. We were aware of them. There was a certain amount of shouting abuse at each other, but it was all pretty light-hearted. So the neighbourhood was really very monochrome. But among my friends, several boys, several girls. I had sisters. My older brother had more or less left home by the time I was growing up. There's quite an age gap between us. Not a wide range of socioeconomic difference, although there were families in the district which we were conscious of being better off, particularly if they had overseas funds and could, in those days, buy an English or an American car, you know, which in the 50s in New Zealand was really reserved to farmers, doctors, and in the case of our neighbourhood, our parish priest, Father Charles Harrison, was English and obviously still had overseas funds, so he had new English cars. Ooh.
What about in terms of homosexuality? Was there any mention when you were growing up of homosexuality?
Not as such, but I was aware of adult conversation about some people whom I now know are homosexual, and I knew that they were being talked about in sort of some slight scandalous way. The gym teacher at Dunedin North Intermediate, so we're talking 56, 57, by then, 1956, 1957, the gym teacher there was known to be gay. He went on to become a professional actor and appeared in one or two English TV programs. There were other people around who were known to be gay. I'm thinking William Menlove and Bernard Esquilant, who were prominent people in the theatre scene in Dunedin. And I should at some point mention the theatre scene in Dunedin because it was significant in my adolescent years. So just an awareness that there were men who lived with, is really what I would say, with men. No, I don't remember any sense of disgust or scandal, really, but and yet I still picked up the impression that this was all a bit sort of doubtful. You know, not quite proper.
We're using the word gay. Is that a word that would have been used?
No.
What wording would be used?
No. One of them. Is he one of them? You know, that was pretty typical. I don't remember what was said. There was some theory that you were a bit suspicious if you wore white socks. I remember that. Who knows? You know, real men wear pink these days, but in those days, white socks were a giveaway. I've been thinking about other words that were used at the time, but I'm not suggesting that they were used in my family or in conversation that I ever heard. But, you know, deviant, queer, invert, fairy, faggot, more US than New Zealand, but fairy was reasonably common. And then the other ones, you know, shirt lifter and poo pusher and, you know, other things like that.
So were they words that you actually heard at the time, or is this in reflecting back?
Bit of both. Queer, certainly, would be the main one. Mm.
So what age were you aware of these conversations starting to happen?
Well, I think I'd have been about 10 or 11, sort of saying 1954, 55. It was at about that time that I was becoming sexually aware myself, though I couldn't at that time have put the label homosexual on myself. But by then I knew that I was growing up differently from my boyhood friend George. As his sexual awareness developed, he was interested in women and looking at the Cappy magazine for pictures of nude women and so forth. And I realised that I wasn't really interested. And thinking back, I've still got a couple of books that were given to me, children's books that were given to me in as early as 1952, which had illustrations in them of men who near naked or naked. I mean, one was How the Maoris Lived, and there was a picture of tattooed buttocks. And there was a story about Aladdin where the genie was wearing nothing but a sort of loincloth. And I was fascinated by those. Now, we're talking, 1952, 53. So I'm sort of 8, 9. But by 10 or 11, I was really aware of the difference between the way George's interests were developing and the way my interests were developing.
Can you give me some examples of why do you say that? Why?
I can't remember exactly why we were doing it, but I mentioned the Capping magazine before. There was a Capping magazine that had some caricature or cartoon picture of a nude woman in it. And George wanted me, I was a bit more artistic than he was, George wanted me to trace that and copy it for him and so forth. And I thought, I'm much more interested in the picture of Superman in his tights. Do you know? And I was conscious of that. And there was another occasion when there was an exhibition of nude photography at Glenfalloch, way down the Otago Peninsula. Well, George, we got our bikes and we biked all the way down and we tried to get into Glenfalloch, but we didn't have, and so on. I mean, it was just, he was obsessed with the idea of getting to see this photographic exhibition. And I sort of thought, oh, yeah.
So those thoughts that you were starting to have, and that being conscious of feelings towards men, can you describe what those feelings were? Was it just an intense interest, or was it something
more? No, an intense interest. I mean, at that age, boyhood friendships are more intense than friendships with girls anyway. So it was only once we were getting past that point that the different social interest became evident. I can't be more specific than that, really. Just a growing awareness that my interest was in the male body when other boys' interest was in the female body.
And did that concern you?
No, not really. Being homosexual has never really greatly concerned me, which is an interesting thing when we're going to eventually be talking about aversion therapy. But, a lot of people might think, did you realise it was wrong? Well, I don't think I ever thought of it as wrong. I thought of it as different. I did know that it wasn't something that you talked about. But that's not quite the same thing as thinking it was wrong. I mean, later on, I knew that the church identified it as sinful, and I tried to address that. But not even that really exercised me greatly. I think I was remarkably lucky from that point of view, that a lot of people of my generation were overwhelmed by guilt and shame, and neither of those has really been part of my life, which I think says something of the security of my upbringing in a happy family.
So as a teenager or a young boy growing up, did you actively go around looking for people with white socks?
No, but I was fascinated by this. I must have picked up clearly, well, we talked before about it being men who lived with men. I was certainly intrigued by that. And then as I developed, you know, once I was sexually maturing, well, that was quite different. I mean, by then I wasn't just looking for men with white socks.
What about the theatre scene in Dunedin? You were saying that was quite a big part of your growing up as well.
Right. in, I think, 1959, that's my fourth form year, a high school friend, introduced me to the Globe Theatre. The production that year was Hamlet, and they wanted a couple of boys to play the King and the Queen in the play within the play. And Keith was the King, was the Queen, and I was the King. And so we became involved in the Globe Theatre, Patrick and Rosalie Carey. And that was absolute news to me. I'd never been to a theatre production in my life before. My family, though quite well-read and reasonably cultured, weren't involved in theatre or anything of that sort. And so I was fascinated by all that, and fascinated by the people that I met there as well. And I went on and was in The Duchess of Malfi, Oedipus Rex, Antigone, Waiting for Godot, always as a boy. In Oedipus Rex, I was the boy that led the blind Oedipus around. In Waiting for Godot, I was the boy that turns up and talks to them in the last stages of the play. And so I became aware then that of people who were obviously more theatrical, obviously, several of whom were homosexual, and one or two of whom I came across later. Not that I socialised with them, but I met them here and there. And it was significant because my French teacher knew that I was a wee bit involved in the theatre world, and so when the university French club, or Alliance Française, wanted a boy for a play, my French teacher put my name forward. So I played the boy, the schoolboy, in a Molière production that the French club at the university was putting on. And one of the other bit part players, who was a few years older than me, perhaps 6 years older than me, had been at Otago Boys. He and I were both on at the beginning of the play and the end of the play, so we were hanging around for an hour or more in between times. And he propositioned me. He introduced the topic with, had I read Peyton Place? Now, many people won't even remember Peyton Place, but it was a raunchy novel at the time. And I said, yes, I had, and did it turn me on? Yes, it did. And that led to my first significant sexual experience with another man. And I can still feel the impact, the excitement of undoing his fly. I mean, you know, we're talking 55 years later. So the theatre world had put me in touch with that. That was my first significant sexual experience. And I treasure that moment, really.
And so I'm wondering what happened between being kind of sexually active at 14, 15 and not necessarily having a problem with homosexuality, and then wanting to go and seek treatment for homosexuality. Mm. What happened?
Let's bring two things together. My interest in the church, my increasing involvement with, you know, Bible class, altar service and so forth. I thought I discerned a vocation to the Anglican priesthood. So that's one thing on one side. On the other is that I but then knew that I was homosexual. I couldn't have put this description on by then, but I can now say that I'm a Kinsey 6, that is to say someone who is completely and utterly homosexual and devoid of heterosexual reaction. So you've got those two things, and they were in tension. Not worried about being gay, but wanting to be in the church and knowing the church wasn't all that thrilled about that. What really brought it to a head was that in my first year or two at Selwyn, at Otago University, 1963-64, so by then I'm 1920, I began a sexual relationship with one of the other theological students. Now, we were both in the same parish, and we both reported to the same parish priest, who was very good to me, but also was appalled that this guy and I were in a sexual relationship. And to be fair, I think the guy was probably basically heterosexual, and certainly went on and married and had kids and so forth. I don't know quite why he allowed himself to be involved, but anyway, we were sexually involved for a short period of time, and the parish priest knew both our stories and wasn't happy with that, and suggested to me that really homosexuality was a problem, and that we ought to do what we could about addressing it. And he suggested that I consult the student health psychiatrist, which I was perfectly happy to do. And that student health psychiatrist was Dr. Basil James, who I now know had pioneered aversion therapy in England. So we're now talking late 1964. And by then, I'd done a lot of reading about homosexuality. I'd read reports of psychoanalysis and various, you know, group therapy and goodness knows what. I couldn't see any of those having any effect on me. But I'd never heard of behavioural therapy. And Basil James explained the behaviourist approach to human sexuality, said that he thought that my homosexual interests were learned, and that if something had been learned, whenever, but if something had been learned, it could be unlearned. And he was a proponent of behaviour modification.
Just before we go on with that, I'm just wondering if you can just rewind a wee bit. And with the priest saying it was a problem, do you think that at the time the wider community felt that homosexuality was a problem?
Look, I never experienced it, but I mean, it was still... as far as medicine was concerned, that's what we're talking about, it was sick. As far as the law was concerned, it was a crime. As far as the church was concerned, it was a sin. And, you know, you read in the papers, Truth in particular, the reports of scandalous things. I have to say, most of the things I read about in the newspapers at the time tended to be what we would now call paedophilia, and that's never been the issue for me. I mean, I was interested as a young man, I was interested in older men, and as an older man, I'm interested in younger men. But never in kids. It was never an issue. And most of the newspaper reports were about those sorts of cases. But one guy that I met quite often on the beat, and once went home with, and whose name I know, appeared in the court papers. He'd been arrested for loitering, and was convicted and was jailed. So that was what the wider world thought about it, but I wasn't conscious of that in my own family, or even in the neighbourhood. Unspoken rather than, I mean, just not talked about, rather than talked about with revulsion or disgust.
And did you have any conflict within yourself about what you were doing?
I really didn't. I guess I should have. But I really didn't. I knew this was me. Insofar as I thought about it, I thought, well, okay, God's created me in this way. Can't be all bad. I might have a lot of thoughts about how I dealt with it, what I did with it. But in terms of actually being homosexual, it's never. I've just thought, oh, yeah, okay, well, that's who I am.
And so your relationship with this other student, did you ever talk about what you were doing, or it was just more a physical thing?
Physical thing, really. Mm. Yep. I mean, I was in love with him. Was he with me? Who knows? I mean, we spent all our spare time with each other. We went away on holidays together. This is before it became sexual. We'd been best friends for a year or two by then. And just, you know, one night. He'd been teasing me a bit. Sexually, I mean. And I just said, basically put up or shut up. And he put up.
Teasing you in what way? What?
Oh, just he knew I was gay and knew that I found him attractive. Being a bit provocative in the way... we were out on holiday, say, and just a bit provocative in the way he undressed, or the way he talked about himself. Mm.
And so you and he would both tell the priest what was going on?
Yeah. Well, we were both High Church Anglicans, which meant that sacramental confession was part of the church discipline, in which you fronted up to where you thought you'd fallen short of the standard and expressed regret for it. So that's the context in which it would come out. And the parish priest would have needed, well, because he'd heard it from me. I was just thinking about conflict of you know, confessional secrecy. But anyway, that's how he came to suggest that I see a student health psychiatrist.
Was there anything you didn't tell the priest?
No, that wasn't the deal, really. You fronted up. He was a good guy. He quite apart from the business with this other student, he was also unhappy on my behalf with the amount of cruising I was doing. And he was really quite kind. It must have been pre-decimal currency, I guess it was. That was 67, wasn't it? Because he gave me a coin. I think it was a penny, which would have been the cost of a telephone call. And he said, I want you to carry this with you, and if you are ever in trouble, or if you feel you've got yourself into a situation which you can't handle, or indeed if you just want to stop what you are doing, you ring me at any time, day or night. I never did. But that was a pretty pastorally sensitive way of approaching things, I thought.
So what did you think when it was suggested that you go and talk to a psychiatrist?
I really thought that, see, that this parish priest was also one of the bishop's advisors, so he had some responsibility for the formation of the theological students. And I thought it was reasonable for him to say, this is a problem. I mean, I couldn't quite imagine, it's all a bit different now, but in those days, by and large, Anglican clergy were expected to be, you know, happily married. So although there were a few celibate or single clergy around, I guess I accepted that life would be easier as an Anglican priest if I was straight. I had no great desire to be straight and had no great belief that anything I'd heard of up to then would make any difference, but that nevertheless, life would probably be easier, and if the church was asking me to give this a go, then I should give it a go. I still think that was the right thing to do, and we're jumping ahead, but it having failed, I felt I'd given it a go, I'd done what was expected of me, it hadn't worked, and it was time to get on with life.
At the time, I mean, we're talking about kind of gay and straight. At the time, was it conceivable to have a gay lifestyle where you actually lived quite happily with another man? Or are we talking gay being sexual encounters that were kind of random? And
I was certainly thinking of a partner that I lived with, and I just couldn't see Ralph and David being accepted in the Winton Vicarage. Now, that's a bit unfair on Winton, isn't it? I'm just thinking of, you know, rural Southland or South Otago. I just, you know, it just, although it happens now, that wasn't, you couldn't really contemplate that. I don't know how I thought we were going to manage that. But it was certainly worth giving changing a go when this new behaviourist theory had been put to me.
Can you recall how you felt waiting to see the psychiatrist for the first time?
It was late in the academic year. I think I was pretty just sort of focused on finals and that sort of thing. I don't remember any particular anxieties. Having agreed to go into hospital for this treatment really was an issue, because I really felt very strongly that I had to tell my parents what I was and what I was doing about it. And that was a big, big tension. We got to the stage, the parish priest and I, where I said, I really want to do it. I'm really dreading it. I've got to do it. But if I don't get round to it, will you do it? And he said, of course I will. I'll talk to your mother. Well, in fact, I came out to Mum on the eve of going into hospital.
We'll come back to getting into hospital and telling your parents in a tick, but I'm just wondering, when you first had the meeting with Dr. James,
mm-hmm.
what was it like coming forward with the idea of homosexuality and seeing it as a problem? How did you verbalise what was going on with you?
I think really just that I was conscious that I was homosexual, that I was homosexually active, that this was incompatible with the church's expectations. And, you know, obviously he knew how I'd been referred. The preliminary interviews were really a bit of a farce. I suppose I'd read enough about, you know, psychotherapy and so forth. You know, it was all the same old stuff, you know, talking about your mother and your father and your relationship with your siblings, and, you know, whether you'd ever been sexually interfered with, and all sorts of perfectly standard stuff, reasonable for them to be asking, but you sort of thought, oh dear, yeah, here we go. It all seemed terribly predictable.
And what was his attitude?
He was a cool number, Basil Jones. Mm. And I think that he felt strongly that homosexuality was an unacceptable deviance, and that his professional duty was to do what he could to, well, eradicate it. Because I certainly didn't present to him as a terribly troubled homosexual who had some heterosexual component that could be built on. I mean, I've since read enough about it to know that's the sort of thing they're looking for. Well, you know, someone who was really distressed, really determined to change, and who had some heterosexual experience. Well, I mean, that just wasn't me.
So what kind of language did he use? Can you remember that?
I don't really. Yeah. I've since acquired his notes, but they're almost illegible. And they're very, very brief and cryptic. So I really can't build... I can't recover that.
Cryptic in what way? What?
Just the odd word and an abbreviation and that sort of thing. Just a few little scratches on a page, really. I'm sure they meant something to him at the time, but they didn't mean much to me, you know, 50 years later.
And how did he introduce the concept of behavioural therapy, aversion therapy?
He explained behaviourist therapy, that learned behaviour could be unlearned, and that, you know, the number of troubling behaviours that could be addressed through behaviour modification, and he mentioned alcoholism, gambling, certainly gave you a fair indication of where he thought you fitted into the whole scheme of things. And then just got straight into explaining what the actual process would be.
Did he say if he had done this treatment before in New Zealand?
He didn't. I've since researched that. Yeah. No, I've no awareness of I don't think it was even a reference to him having claimed success overseas. I mean, I know now that he had, but that's not part of my memory of it.
So how did he sell it to you?
You've said you think it would be a good idea to address your problem, and here is this new... or here is this process which you have not previously considered, and I recommend that you undertake this treatment.
Were there other options available in terms of treatments?
Not offered by him. I mean, I guess there were, you know, psychotherapy. Well, to be fair, when I... because I wrote to him well after the aversion therapy, and he did at that point talk about... other possibilities, particularly group therapy. My experience of any sort of group therapy of that sort tends to be that you certainly share your problems, but my view is that if there were two or three gay people in a group, you'd be far more likely to end up having sex than addressing the problem. I don't know.
So he then went through the procedure of actually what would happen. And how did he describe that?
In very neutral terms. And some of the details I didn't tune into at the time. It was only once I was actually there that I realised how awful it was going to be, really. I don't mean he misled me. I just mean that he concentrated sort of on the theory of it, you know. He did tell me what would happen, that he would be using a drug. I don't think he ever identified it, though I now know what it is. That there would be a drug and it would make me sick. I had to provide erotic images and some anecdotes that I had found that would excite me. And he used those anecdotes to make up a tape that was played at the same time of the treatment. Shall I just describe what was involved? The first thing I need to comment on is that I was admitted to Cahoon Ward in Dunedin, which was the psychiatric ward. Now, that's not a good start, and in those days, forgetting whether homosexuality was a particular issue, mental illness certainly was. And you certainly looked twice at people who'd been in Cahoon.
Is this a public hospital?
Yeah, in Dunedin public. So anyway, into a small room, blacked out, bed, nothing else. The first treatment, dose of tumbler of whiskey, a shot of apomorphine in the bum, play the tape. Starts off with the anecdote that's exciting, and then within a minute or so says, you know, this is making you feel ill, you are feeling very sick, you are, and at that point, of course, the apomorphine effects, and you throw up the whiskey, and that's that session over. After the first session, my blood pressure dropped drastically. Don't know why, but it did. So they had to sort of modify things. And after that, the sessions were every 2 hours with some glucose and lime in between. No food through this period and no leaving the room. So I must have urinated and defecated in the room. I don't actually remember that, although I do remember the room getting, you know, more and more foul. I mean, he's a young man in his early 20s, sweating and puking all over the place, so that was pretty grim. And that followed every 2 hours. So apomorphine and the tape, then followed by glucose and lime, then followed by another session of apomorphine and the tape, on and on and on.
How long were you there for?
The records show 9 days. I'm surprised at that. I didn't think I was there that long. I mean, I knew I'd put up with several days of it, and then I decided I've had enough of this, and I insisted, when the orderlies came in to give me another dose, I insisted on seeing Basil James. So we had a discussion in which I said, look, this is enough's enough, I'm not continuing with this. And he sort of said, oh, you know, what would my parents think if I gave up, and what would the church think if I gave up, and da-di-da-di-da. And he said, I really do suggest that you continue with this treatment. So I said, okay, I will. And that appeared, the fact that I had now apparently acknowledged and given a commitment to continuing to attempt to go on with this attempt to change me, apparently was what he was looking for. Because immediately the treatment stopped. I'm up, I'm showered, the room is, curtains are put up, flowers are put in, the middle-aged males turned into nubile young females. Do you see what I mean? I presume it was my commitment to continuing that he was looking for. Anyway, so that was session one.
I want to go back over session one just in a wee bit more detail, but we haven't picked up the story of coming out to your parents.
Mm.
Can you recount how that happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, I felt that I couldn't, I mean, I didn't know how long I was going to be in hospital, but, you know, obviously it was going to be about 10 days at least. And I felt I really can't just disappear like this. It's just not what my relationship with Mum and Dad is like. So, on the night before I went in, I finally got round to talking to Mum. She was doing ironing, and I sort of said, Mum, you know, I'm now turned 20 and I still don't have a girlfriend, and you may have noticed on my bookshelf that there are a number of books about homosexuality. And I think I need to say that that's what I am, and that I'm going into hospital for some treatment that may make a difference to this. And she said, you'll need clean pyjamas. So that was... You know, that was her matter-of-fact, caring-for-her-son response. And we really didn't talk about it anymore. She didn't want to talk about it anymore, but she accepted it, as what was happening. I don't think it came as any great surprise. And she just wanted to make sure that I was clean and tidy, you know. So, have I talked about it since with her? Not significantly. But it rapidly became... See, not long after that, I hitched up with David, the partner I had for 30-odd years, and he and I were just absorbed into the family and treated, really, as far as I can tell, apart from weddings and wedding presents, we were treated the same way that my married brothers and sisters were, by both sides of the family, his family and mine. There was no pretense. Mum and Dad came to stay with us often. We went down there and stayed with them. That was all very matter of fact, which I thought was pretty good. Because, I mean, through other associations, I've known of people who young men whose photos, whose faces were cut out of family photos because the family would not accept. Well, I mean, they were simply totally excluded, written out of the record. That's just not my experience. I need to make the general point. You know this notion that dogs bite people who expect to be bitten? I sort of feel it applies to my life in a way, that the young men I've dealt with who were terribly traumatised and were having trouble with bosses and workmates and so forth, somehow, I don't mean deserved it, but... I assumed that I would be treated with respect for myself and that I was not going to be discriminated against, even though it was still illegal. And that was my expectation. And I have to say that with very few exceptions, and there were one or two, but with very few exceptions, family was okay, friends were okay, employers were okay, workmates were okay. Never had any problem.
Having books on your shelf about homosexuality, I mean, that must have been a pointer for your mother.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
How did that come about?
Well, you know, by then, you see, I'm a theological student by then. So I was, you know, there were pastoral books, there were liturgical books, pastoral books, books about pastoral issues, broadly. I mean, there weren't raunchy gay novels. There was things like D.J. West's Homosexuality and things like that, and by then a book which was really a how to do it manual. It was a book called Minority, published by Gordon Westwood. That was a pseudonym for someone else, and I shoplifted that from a bookshop in Dunedin. I was too ashamed to take it up to the counter and buy it. This is confession time. And honestly, it was a sociological study full of heavy data. Of research that was done in England, Britain, England, can't remember which, but it had lots of anecdotal stuff. So it had people of about my age and inclination describing how they met someone in an underground toilet or whatever. And it was basically, and this is what you do, these are the signs you look out for, these are the risks you're taking. Do it yourself, manual. Anyway... So there was stuff like that. But it was, it was in the context, I mean, it's not why I had them, but it was in the context of a wider range of things to do with, you know, pastoral care and other aspects of theological training.
So when you told your mother and she said, oh, you know, make sure you pack the pyjamas, how did you feel? Had you booked this up in your mind as this is going to be a pivotal moment? Or
yeah, I had really. Yes, I mean, I knew I had to do it, and I was dreading doing it. More out of embarrassment than any sense that I was going to be disowned, to be honest. I mean, our family, in terms of family, I had no sex education whatsoever. And I have to say that other men of my age had the same experience. Yeah. So sex wasn't, things sexual were just not talked about. Not tutted over, we were all bright enough to know that this was a scenario that, you know, wasn't proper for dinner table conversation, really. I talked to my younger sister by then, not to my older sister or brother, neither of them lived at home by then. Talked to my younger sister, not an issue. I talked to an employer, not an issue. I talked to college friends, other theological students, not an issue. But Mum, just terribly matter-of-fact, but not really keen to talk about it.
And she told your father?
Yeah. And they had, I now know, I suppose I suspected at the time, they had an interview with Basil James, because there's a reference to that in his notes, but no details of what they discussed.
And that was prior to the first session?
No, it would have been after the first session, I think, or during it even. I think probably during it.
Do you know what your father's reaction was?
The only time I've had any conversation with Dad about it at all, he really talked about the law. Not necessarily that it was right or wrong, but about the importance of law as a regulating device in society, that laws were there for good reason, that whether or not we agreed with them, we were bound as citizens to obey them. And that figured with the sort of approach he took to life generally. I think in that conversation we even talked about the origins of Roman law and that sort of thing. But that was the aspect he took. That's interesting. And that's really the only explicit conversation.
Can you recall prior to the treatment, after talking to Dr. James, between talking to him and then going in for the first session, how you felt? What was going through your head?
Apprehensive about it, but pretty distracted by the holiday job I had by then and waiting for university results and that sort of thing. I don't remember being terribly keyed up about it, other than the issue of needing to tell Mum.
Did Dr. James give you any warnings beforehand as to, you know, could things possibly go wrong?
No. No, I don't remember any discussion of the actual drug or of the risks involved. That may be reprehensible on his part, because I now know that, I think the case was South Africa, but there might have been in Britain as well, of people who have actually died of the epimorphine. I mean, gay men under treatment have died of a reaction to the drug. But no, I didn't believe there was any physical risk in that sense.
And did you have to sign some kind of waiver that would...
Look, I don't remember that. I mean, that seems extraordinary, because now, of course, as a privacy officer, I have to get people to sign waivers for everything. But no, I don't remember that either. I don't know whether I'd have mentioned it. Well, there was a second session, which you're aware of, which you might want to explore, but also that I had a final outpatient's session with electric shock. Not convulsive shock, but just electricity instead of nausea-inducing drugs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll come to that.
Right.
So prior to the first session, you were asked to come up with some images and some stories. What can you give me some examples of what you kind of came up with?
I can't remember what UC made of the images, because I don't remember them being part of it. But, it seems extraordinary, really. But in those days, there really wasn't a lot of gay pornography around. But there were athletic magazines. And there was one in particular called Man's World, which I now know was produced solely for the gay market. But in those days, they were kept with the sports and the health magazines. And they were small booklets of black and white photos of men of all ages, but mostly bodybuilder types in quite provocative poses. So I had a few of those. I gave him one of those. And in terms of anecdotes, I talk about the sort of men that attracted me or the sort of things out on the beat that excited me, which were not necessarily quite the same thing, because there was an element of excitement in the hunt, you know, regardless of what the prey was, sort of thing. You know, there was a wee frisson of excitement from, you know, of the danger. And I did think police danger. I didn't think nowadays, of course, I think the danger of being bashed up, getting it wrong, and being. But you know, one was so circumspect that really there was very little danger of getting it wrong.
What was his reaction to that material?
Oh, quite neutral. Mm. No, he was very professional at that. He was a cool customer. And yeah, I won't jump ahead to the second session because there's a sort of parallel there.
So, can you tell me what it was like being admitted to a public hospital psychiatric ward?
Not nice, basically. And one of the consequent reactions, short-lived, but nevertheless, both within family, the more extended members of family, and certainly among some families in the district, not that they didn't know why I'd been in there, but they knew that I'd been in Cahoon. So that people I had babysat for no longer wanted me as a babysitter. That's the sort of thing. And even family members. Just that sense of, you know, what's wrong with him? He's been in Cahoon. What's that all about? I wonder, is he okay? Thoughtful for me. Is he safe? Is he going to take an axe and attack us? I'm inventing all that, but just a reserve. Not because I was gay or because they knew that, but simply that I had been in Cahoon.
How did the medical staff treat you?
The only doctor I saw was Basil James, but the orderlies who administered the drug, again, they were neutral, but I was embarrassed because one, and one of my notes from way back then suggests that there were two, but I certainly remember one of the orderlies was someone I'd been at school with. He was in med school now. You know, because here we are, we're at the end of my second year at Varsity. He was in med school and he was, you know, doing work as an orderly. And I didn't care for that. There were no consequences of that. I never heard that he had mentioned anywhere that he'd met me or why I was there or anything like that, but I didn't like it.
And for them, this would have been the first time they had tried this treatment?
I hope it was the only time, but I can't guarantee that. I actually ought to put an official information request about that. I might one day. But yes, it would have been.
So can you take me through, after being admitted, where were you shown? Where did you go? Where were you taken?
Pretty much straight to the room that I've described.
How big was that room?
Pretty small, enough room for a bed. I suppose it was a bedside cabinet. I recall it as, you know, a standard old-fashioned hospital window with a bit of wall on each side. I don't want to be saying 2.5 metres by 4 or something like that.
And it was blacked out?
Blacked out. Yeah, no, blacked out, no decoration. I'm inclined to say unshaded light bulb, but I can't actually remember that. But that was the general impression. It was a cell.
And were you able to leave that room?
No. I didn't.
D- Did you know that going into that room that you wouldn't be able to leave for so many days?
Oh, I think I knew that I was submitting myself to whatever came.
So you're there in the room, what happens next?
They come in and say, we're ready for the first treatment. They give me the shot of whiskey, the tumbler of whiskey. I roll over, they inject apomorphine into my backside. They turn the tape recorder on.
Did they say what the injection would do?
Oh, I knew it was going to induce nausea. I didn't know what or how bad the nausea would be, but I knew it would, yes. Oh, yes, Basil James had explained what the modification involved. Yeah. Yep. It's just that, you know, thinking about it in theory, like, you know, this rat gets an electric shock every time it goes to the wrong feeder. Yeah, it's all a bit sort of clinical, but scientific. That was what attracted me to it. Well, that's what, because I'd never heard of it before, and this was something, you could sort of see the logic of it. God help me, but you could see the logic of it. You know? And so then, yes, and as I say, after the first one, you've thrown up in the bowl, they took the bowl away, but, you know, I mean, you had no change of pyjamas or sheets or anything like that. You were just there in this room for as long as it took.
The tape, was that Basil?
That was Basil's voice, yes.
And Basil was describing your fantasies,
Yep.
How was that to listen to?
Well, slightly embarrassing in front of an orderly, but, I mean, I was playing fair with the whole thing. I mean, I'd given the anecdotes to Basil, so I couldn't really complain about Basil reading them back to me.
So did the orderly stay in the room with you?
Yeah. I don't know whether that was part of the deal or whether, particularly after that first one where my blood pressure had dropped, where they felt that there needed to be someone there. And they'd take away the basin.
So do you think it worked? Was the intention that you would get aroused and then...
That's part of what's so completely and utterly pathetic about it. As I've said once or twice since, you had to be, theoretically, you had to be thoroughly aroused to be completely turned off. You don't get aroused in those circumstances. I mean, I could honestly say, although I listened to, took in the anecdotes that I'd relayed and were now being relayed to me, I mean, it was just a non-sexual situation. When one thinks of good sex, one doesn't think of a middle-aged orderly in a foul-smelling room with no light and your bum full of apomorphine. It was just, but looking back on it, was just pathetic. Barbaric, pathetic, illogical.
So what would the time difference be between actually the start of the tape happening and you throwing up? How long would that take?
Oh, 2-3 minutes at most. Yeah, so the drug acted quite fast and the tape wasn't terribly long and it went quite quickly from, you know, isn't this exciting, to you are feeling sick. And of course it was no surprise she was feeling sick because she'd had a bum full of nausea inducing drug.
Was there any wording on the tape to make you feel bad, like homosexuality is bad, or you're a sinner?
Oh, yes.
Or
what kind
of words would it be?
Disgusting. Yeah. That would be the approach. Yeah, this is disgusting behaviour. You are feeling sick. You are sickened by this disgusting behaviour. I mean, I can't. But that was the theme. Yeah. You are, yes. That's the first way of summarising it. You are sickened by this disgusting behaviour. You are feeling sick. You are really, really sick. This behaviour makes you sick. On and on.
And so you would throw up after a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
And then what would happen?
They'd go away and you waited for an hour and then you got a tumbler of glucose and lime, and then an hour after that you had another session.
Was there anything... in the room that, like, I mean, were there books that you could read?
No. No. Absolutely no external stimulation. No. You in your head.
And what was going on in your head?
A pretty strong reaction to begin with. And as I say, after what I now gather was a few days, I thought, this is just bloody ridiculous. Enough's enough. I'm not going to have another one of these. I'm a voluntary patient. I'm not going to have another one of these. I insist on seeing Basil James.
How many treatments a day would you get?
Well, I think it was every 2 hours, so 12 in a day. It might have been slightly less than that, but I don't think it was. That's why I can't really believe I was there 9 days. I suppose the 9 days would include the post-therapy day or two of recovery. I don't know. I'm surprised at that.
So it went all day and all night?
Yeah. As far as you could tell. No watch, no light, no sense of whether it was day or night outside.
Was it the same orderlies or were there...
No, different orderlies. They must have been on shifts. There were some who were there more than once, but no, different orderlies. But all male and mostly older men.
Did they converse with you at all?
No. Just very professional, reserved, neutral. They must have been pretty heavily briefed. I mean, obviously I was supposed to be in isolation and I was not supposed to be sympathised with or supported, yeah, basically.
Was there anything in the room that allowed people outside the room to observe your behaviour?
No. No. Open and closed door, door shut. No. If there was a window to the corridor, and there may have been, but it was well curtained out, well blacked out. I wasn't aware of people coming and going outside at all.
And was anybody actually checking up on you and saying, you know, how are you feeling, what are your thoughts?
No. Not till I insisted on seeing Basil James.
Do you think that was part of it, where they would basically do it until you actually threw up your hands and said, I'm not doing it anymore?
Yeah, I think that's... I haven't read other people's experiences, or at least I haven't until very recently, and they're only in a comic context. But I happened upon quite recently a wee novel by Tom Sharp, South African writer, called Indecent Exposure, and in the South African police, they became aware that a lot of the white policemen were in fact fraternising with black women. And for the authorities, this was an absolute... No, it was also a crime. So they decided that they were going to deal with this. And they decided to deal with it by aversion therapy. And so they wholesaled this treatment. So the novel says. And it's borne out to some extent because some of the more recent research stuff is from South Africa.
Over that time of that first session of aversion therapy, were you able to have a shower or...
No.
And you were saying that you had to toilet within the room itself?
It must have, because I didn't leave the room. Oddly enough, I certainly know I had no shower and that I was becoming increasingly smelly and sticky. I must have been under a fair bit of mountain pressure, to be honest, because we've talked a wee bit about religion and may come back to it, but somewhere along that line, well into it, and possibly critical to my calling for Basil James, I had a sense of, quite explicitly, Jesus Christ being present with me. Nothing more than presence and comfort from that presence. Now, I don't actually believe in that sort of event, you see. So I'm sort of telling it at my own expense. But that was quite strong. Now, I mean, I'm inclined to think, you know, if you haven't been with food or proper nourishment for several days. It's no wonder you start hallucinating. I mean, that's pretty normal. But it was interesting that it took that form. Anyway, so you were asking what was going on in my head. Well, I must have been getting increasingly stressed and affected by the whole process. And then I had that experience, and I think that sense that, you know, I was being supported by other was part of my determination to call, to say enough's enough. I don't remember Jesus Christ saying it's all right, Ralph, I love you. But I think that's what I felt, which was consistent with what I've said before. I've never actually felt disowned by God, you know? So
what was the point of the whiskey?
I don't know. I think you had to have something to throw up on, and if you weren't being fed, you had to have something in your system. Whether it was a carryover from other use of the treatment for alcoholics, I just don't know. But I mean, I can joke about it now, but I mean, I wouldn't touch a glass of whiskey to this day. And in the first few years after this, there used to be a coloured magazine that often had a Johnny Walker advert on the back cover, full colour advert on the back cover, and a tumbler of whiskey, and it would make me feel queasy. So it didn't do anything to my sexuality, but it sure put me off whiskey. But so I don't know what that was about, but I think that I can only think that it was a carryover from, you know, that with an alcoholic they were actually giving him something that he was supposed to be made sick by. And they certainly had to give me something, so that's what it was.
The tape message, did that change over the time?
No.
It was the same wording?
Same message, yeah. I don't think it was even modified. I don't think there were even two versions of it. I think it was just... Which again's a bit pathetic, isn't it? You know, I mean, you know, you've been made sick by one anecdote.
And what kind of tone of voice did he use on the tape?
Oh, quite neutral. Although... Oh, no, quite neutral in describing the whatever the anecdote was. But then, you know, then a bit more dramatic. You know, you are feeling sick. You are feeling very sick. You are going to be sick. Sort of thing.
God. I imagine it must have been quite intense for the orderlies as well. I mean, if they were in the room with you.
Yeah, quite like that. And so they knew why I was there, because they were listening to these tapes, including my old schoolmates. But anyway, oh well. I quite fancied one of the group of schoolmates, but anyway, that's beside the point.
So you finally got kind of fed up with the treatment and you called for Dr. James.
Yep.
How quickly did he arrive?
Before the next session.
What was the discussion about?
Just my saying that that I wasn't prepared to put up with this. That I thought it was a dreadful treatment, that it was a dreadful process, not blaming him, but that it was a dreadful process, and that I wasn't prepared to continue with it. And then he began this, you know, what will your parents think, you know, don't you feel you have an obligation to them and to the church authorities to continue with this treatment, don't you realise that, you know, it will make your life better, and you know that it's that's behaviour that needs to change, and so on. Oh, all right.
What was going through your head?
Well, really, respect for Mum and Dad more than. He may have told me at that point that he'd spoken to them. I was more focused on them than I was on the church authorities. I may by then have begun to realise that, in fact, I wasn't going to make it into the Anglican priesthood, although I continued a bit after that. really just that, you know, I've made a commitment to seeing this through, and now he laid the guilt on me with over Mum and Dad in particular, and that really, oh well, you know, I owed it to them if not to myself.
At that stage, had you any kind of concept of time, how many days you'd been there?
No. I knew, I didn't call him until I was fed up. So I knew that there'd been a lot of sessions.
And so you agreed to continue?
I did. Yep.
And he left?
Well, he must, I think he signalled there and then, right, that was it. And then, you know, within a very short space of time, I was whisked out to the showers, and given a meal, and the curtains were hung, and flowers were put on the bedside table, and Mum and Dad and my friends were able to visit. And I can't remember how long after that. I don't think I was in much longer than that. On that session.
And just to clarify, that during the time of the treatment, did you actually have any food?
Not that I recall, no. Just the glucose and lime. I mean, I was being given... I mean, that was for very basic sustenance. And the whiskey, of course. But I lost the whiskey.
So, did many people come and visit you?
No, I don't really remember. See, by then it was already university holidays, and most of my friends by then were university friends, and they had all left town. That was a bit of a problem, which we might come on to.
And what about your parents? Did they visit?
They visited, yeah.
And how were they?
Oh, okay. We talked about the weather and what the cat was doing and what the latest news from my older sister was, and family life continued. There was certainly no discussion of what had been happening or why it was happening. But that was typical of my family, really. Not that they're particularly prudish or uptight, but we just did not talk about sex.
So, was there some kind of debriefing after the treatment?
Not that I recall.
So literally you just...
Went home.
Went home.
Mm-hmm.
Does that strike you as odd?
Again, you see, we're right in the period when New Zealand closes down. I think, to be fair, there was probably an appointment made for early in the new year for me to see Basil James again then. But I don't recall any debriefing. Perhaps I should say that the whole experience was a wee bit numbing, and I think I have closed down, I have excluded from my memory some aspects of it. And I also think that in some ways it had a bit of an effect on my recall to that date. I just feel I'm vaguer about some aspects of my earlier life than, say, Max is about his, really. It may just be difference in the way one's mind operates. But I do feel that there's a wee bit of a blur at that point.
So did Basil James tell you what you may expect after the treatment?
No, not that I recall. No.
And what happened after the treatment? How did you know it was successful or not?
Well, I knew it wasn't successful. I mean, I wasn't, in terms of my sexual responses, I certainly, there was no change that I was aware of. And sometime early in the new year, perhaps first week of the new year, you know, here I am in Dunedin. I think Mum and Dad had gone away for a brief holiday, and all my friends are gone. I was bored, I was lonely, and I was fed up. And so I went cruising. And I didn't normally take much interest in the wharves, but and I can't remember. But anyway, I met a really, really lovely guy who was a steward on a coastal trader. And I spent the night with him. You see, you know, no one in town, mum and dad not there. I didn't normally spend the night with people. Spent the night with him on the ship. And it was just lovely. I've joked about it in the past, but, you know, the whole thing has got a sort of golden aura to it. Now, in fact, you know, that was really just the light from a wee bedside radio, but, you know, the whole thing, he was a nice guy, he was sexually attractive to me, we hit it off, and I just thought, I'm back to normal. This is me. This is the way I am. And it's okay. However, that's not the end of the story.
How much time had elapsed from that night to actually when the first treatment ended?
I'd say most of December, a month or 6 weeks perhaps.
And in that time, had you had any kind of sexual thoughts or?
Oh yeah, gay. I mean, not sexual. Yeah, in terms of masturbation, I mean, it hadn't made any difference whatsoever.
So, what were your thoughts on the treatment then?
Waste of time. But I made a commitment to trying it. That must sound odd, but that really was the driver. I hadn't felt driven to the treatment in the first place, but having made the commitment to it, I mean, noses are stickers.
And had you had any communication with the priest who had advised you to get help?
I must have over that Christmas period, and there would have been a general, you know, hope you're okay, and yes, thank you, Father, but nothing more than that. And it was slightly complicated. The theological student with whom I'd been, you know, sort of almost up to, or close to when I went for treatment for the therapy. We communicated, but we stayed well away from the recent past, or what, at that point, we stayed well away from the recent past, or what I'd just been through.
Did he undertake any kind of treatment?
No. Had no need to, really. I pushed him into a relationship that he was quite happy with for the few months that it lasted. But, I mean, I don't really think that was him.
So, what was your next meeting with Basil James?
Well, it would have been, I'd suggest, in sort of mid-January or something like that. And
this is 1965?
1965. Possibly late January. And I told him what had happened in the meantime. Both that I didn't detect any change in my sexual interests and that I'd had a sexual experience. He was always cool and neutral, but it was pretty clear to me that he didn't think this was at all a good thing. And he said that he really thought it was important for us to seize the moment, to build on the first treatment, and I committed myself to seeing it through. So I agreed to return. And not prompted by me, but certainly part of his pattern, the second session was... First session had been very much reorientation. Suppress homosexual reaction. Deorientation. Suppress homosexual reaction. The second session had a bit more focus on reorientation. Suppress the undesirable, encourage the desirable. Now, what illustrated that? He produced some girly magazines, the parallel, really, of the gay ones, the homosexual ones I'd given him, I mean, again, pre-Playboy, so black and white and a bit grainy, but nevertheless, quite explicit porn. And he had a tape which was encouraging heterosexual, encouraging an interest in women. And so this is after the second session, I've given these girly magazines an encouraging tape and a hormone shot. And I don't know what it was or what it was intended to do, but I think it was sort of intended to stimulate sexual interest, which they trusted me to focus on the girly magazine and the encouraging tape. So that was a bit more of an effort. So instead of just attempting to leave me neutral, they really did put more effort into refocusing.
And that second treatment, was that in the same room?
As far as I recall, certainly the same ward.
And they were doing the same routine of a blacked-out room, no other stimulus?
Yeah, same thing. It was all a bit, I've been here before, but still.
Were they making you feel better by... Were they giving you food? Were they... No. So it was exactly the same routine every...
As far as I recall, it was a complete repeat. Except for after the session. And I don't actually remember what brought that lot to a close. I think Basil Dane simply indicated that, you know, he had scheduled a number of sessions and that we had now completed those and that we would now look at encouraging. And the only treatment after that was an outpatient session with electrodes on my hand. Which was the same sort of thing, except that it was, you know, wasn't particularly disgusting. Attached electrodes to your hand. I had to think of a homosexually stimulating experience and then signal, and Basil James would close the circuit and I'd get a jolt. And I have to say that after that's happened several times, you know, perhaps half a dozen times, image, hand up, jolt, image, hand up, jolt, image, hand up, no jolt, but the image disappears from your mind in anticipation of having another shock. I wasn't prepared to say at the time, but I thought that it might have had more effect than the nausea. But of course, I mean, the whole thing is just so pathetic. Because how does he know? I mean, here I am sitting in an outpatient's room with a doctor. I mean, what sort of stimulating thoughts am I going to... But I mean, I could have been thinking of seagulls. I might have been being put off seagulls, for all he knew. I mean, it's silly, isn't it? You see the logic of the theory, but all the loopholes in the way it was applied... And, you know, human beings are just more complex than that. You can stop a rat eating from the wrong feeder, but human beings, especially in their sexual element, are far more complex than that. Just ridiculous.
That second session, how long did that aversion therapy go for?
Don't know. Can't recall. Several days. And the notes are unclear. I really wanted to get that all sorted out in my mind, but the hospital notes are unclear.
And do you know how it ended? Was it again one of those things where you put up your hands
no,
and don't want
no,
to do?
No, it wasn't. No, I think because they had something in their minds to follow it up with, that he had determined a set number of sessions. That's my recall of it.
Was there anything different from the second session of therapy to the first session?
No, only the follow-up. No follow-up after the first. This heterosexual encouragement following the second.
Was there any talk before you were discharged about, you know, how you might be feeling and...
Just, you know, take this material with you and we do encourage you to, you know, to do everything you can to resist temptation and develop this new interest. Not that I'd ever confessed to a new interest, but anyway.
And so how did that kind of pan out?
No different from the previous time. And you see, not long after that, so we're now talking the beginning of 1965. 1963 and 64, I was living at home. 1965, 1966, I was at Selwyn College as a boarder, where the theological student was also a resident. And we were okay. We were back to Newton. We knew that it was no-go area. And every night we gather around about 9 o'clock for supper in one room or another. And one night, another guy, with whom I was quite friendly, said, it's just, because this is right at the beginning of term, beginning of March, I've had a really troubling holiday period. A really close friend from Timaru has told me that he's homosexual. And I just don't know what to make of it or what to do about it. So Ken and I looked at each other, and I sort of said, okay, and he said, okay. And I said, well, John, I'm homosexual too. Do you think, and the conversation developed, and it was, did he think there was anything I could do to help his friend? So it was arranged that I would meet this friend, and I did. We lived together for the next 30 years. Well, not quite. I mean, we courted. And then when his mother died, we moved into a flat together and lived from 1968 till he died in 1995. Now, David, the guy who became my partner, he had also been in Basil James's care because he really was troubled by his homosexuality. And Basil James certainly hadn't suggested any sort of reorientation or anything to him. But Basil James had indicated to David that to continue a homosexual life would almost certainly mean suicide, social or actual suicide.
After meeting David, did you have any correspondence with Basil James about...
I did.
And how did that turn out?
I wrote to him basically... he'd written to me to say that there was a fifth-year medical student who was doing research in the area of homosexuality, not aversion therapy, but homosexuality, and would I be prepared to talk to him? And I did, and I'd completely forgotten his name, but there's a reference to him in Basil James's correspondence, which I've since got from the hospital board, and I've come across a reference to his research in another book where it refers to me, not by name, but it's absolutely me, and I've checked that this indeed was the student I spoke to. So that was that. I wrote what was probably a pompous 21-year-old's letter to Basil James, sort of asking him why he thought it had failed and there were two or three things I tackled him on, and what did he suggest I could do to make life better for gay people? And he responded to that. He said that he thought I wasn't, really terribly strongly motivated to the treatment, which I'd have to agree. And he basically said that he thought there was a note of grandiosity in my last suggestion, and that really, the situation might get better, but that he didn't advise me to be involved in anything, and that really I would need to proceed with the utmost discretion. So.
Did that happen pre the outpatient experience?
No. A year or so later.
Okay, so can we go back to the outpatient experience?
Sure.
So what was the time difference between the end of the second session of aversion therapy and you as an outpatient?
Week or two.
And did Basil just want you to come in as an outpatient to see how it all went?
Yeah. Yep, and that was never repeated, so I don't know whether I presume he simply decided that I was a lost cause.
So, I mean, can you go through that outpatient experience, the idea of going back and seeing how it was going? Was that some before you checked out at the second session? Did he say come back in a week's time? And
I think there was always that understanding that there would be a not an emergency type session, but simply that, you know, that we were committed to checking out how things were going. And at that point, I don't think I had any, you know, further escapades to report to him. I don't recall that. It was just that, you know, here's a top-up. You know, different medium, and just to sort of reinforce that.
And can you describe for me how that electric shock treatment worked? Like, what kind of room you were... Is it
just his office.
Was this a public hospital, or...?
It must have been if he had that gear with me. He wouldn't have had that at Student Health. Yes, he must have had an office within the hospital surrounds.
And what kind of gear? What was it?
Well, it was just a small generator and a couple of nodes and a button to push. Nothing terribly elaborate.
Did the generator make a noise?
No. It was probably connected to low-powered battery or something of that sort. Yeah, the shock was only about... Did you ever do science experience with those? One of the things in high school science back in those days was to generate electricity and hold hands, and the shock ran down the whole lot of you, all that sort of thing. It was about that level. It was a jolt, but, you know, no sense. A jolt and unpleasant, but not... not significant, really. And with a jolt, you know, it's gone over. But, of course, that's what happened with the image in your mind, too. Gone. If you're dreaming about having sex with someone and you get a shock on the hand, you don't go on dreaming.
So do you think the idea was always to have those two different types of therapy?
No. The electric shock had never been discussed in terms, in the initial conversations. And he was always quite fair, saying, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how we do it, and this is what your part in the process is, like, you know, image and signaling and so forth. All quite neutrally explained.
Can you describe some of the images and how they were? Were they projected, or were they...
That's what was so silly. As I say, I could have been thinking of seagulls.
So what would he say to you? How, think of an erotic image.
Yes, think of an erotic and signal me when you've conjured up something of interest to you. So presumably at that point he accepted that the second session, even though it ended up with focus on heterosexual behaviour, hadn't really had much effect. I mean, we didn't go into a lot of that, but here he was continuing to reinforce the deorientation. And as I've admitted, you know, perhaps if it had gone on, it might have had some more profound effect than the nausea sessions had.
Did he give you any instruction in terms of the images you should have in your head?
No, just they needed to be homosexual and attractive.
And did you find it easy or hard to conjure up the images?
Well, look, honestly, I mean, not hard to conjure up the image, but no sense of arousal, really. I mean, for God's sake, I'm in a doctor's office. I mean, I played fair. I don't think of, you know, some attractive man or... Usually just an image like that, really. Not necessarily doing anything, but I played fair. I would conjure up an image of someone I felt attracted to and signal, and bing.
And when bing happened, when he shocked you, can you describe that?
Just like that, you know. He'd close the circuit. The shock would come and the image would go bang, bing. And then there'd be a rest of a minute or something, during which I was expected to, you know, start the process again of conjuring up something, and then I'd eventually signal and close. And as I say, after, I don't know, half a dozen of those, he didn't close the circuit, but an expectation if in my mind the image disappeared.
Was the shock enough to make you kind of verbalise, or, I mean, was it a big shock?
No. No. It was strong enough to be unpleasant, but, you know, not even, no, I wouldn't even yell out or anything. I mean, not even, you know, shit. It just,
And the electrodes, they were placed on your hand?
Yes, I remember. So, I'm sure there were two. Don't know why there'd be two, but anyway, just tape to your hand.
And why did he stop? Why was there a you know, he said, I'm going to do this 10 times, and then...
You know, by then we were very much in his office hours, and I think, you know, I was there for the allotted 40 minutes or whatever, do 50 minutes and then 10 minutes off or whatever, and that was that. I never went back, but I wasn't. He wrote to me about the medical student, and I wrote to him about, you know, what I should do in life.
So after that third treatment, what were your thoughts on the two types of treatment?
My notes made at the time, I've said to myself, perhaps electric shock would have been more effective in the long run than the nausea treatment. But I mean, all I can say is thank God I didn't follow that up. Because, I mean, all it was going to do was leave me, frankly, sexually neutral, or to the point where I was so screwed up that I couldn't function sexually without fear and punishment. And that, you know, that had never been part of my approach to exercising my sexuality. I didn't think God was going to punish me, and although I thought the law might, I didn't, you know. I'm so glad that it didn't work out, because really to be left sort of sexually neutral would be pretty grim, I think.
So what do you think the lasting effects of aversion therapy have been on you?
I've already said that I wonder whether that whole period has been part of blurring some memories. Don't know really whether that's so. The suspicion of someone who'd been in Cahoon lasted for a while, but was never a major issue, and I soon left Dunedin anyway. I still won't have a glass of whiskey. But the lasting effect is I gave it a go. That's what society and the church asked of me. I tried. It hasn't worked. It was never likely to work. I am quite sure that my sexual orientation is inbuilt, whether it was pre-birth or in early relationships. I haven't chosen this. It's me. It's the way I am. Get on with it. And I felt that I was cleared to get on with it by having given it a go. And I suppose in one or two situations since, not in personal ones, but perhaps during law reform, the fact that I was able to say, now look, society, this is what you asked me to do to change. I gave it my best shot. It didn't work. I am sure that it wouldn't work for me or for anyone else. Now, can we move on to another subject? Yeah. So quite profound in a way. I mean, other people got on and found partners and lived with them without that. But given the church background, the family background, the feeling that they'd expected this of me, I'd risen to the occasion, it hadn't worked. And now, time to live life as a gay man and do it as decently as you could.
It's interesting because as we've been talking, you have been referring back to notes that you've obtained from the hospital
mm-hmm.
and research that you've downloaded from the internet. So you've obviously still kept an active interest in or trying to discover more about what happened back then.
Yeah. Yes, that's certainly so. That's partly because, to the best of my knowledge, and I joked about an official information request, but to my knowledge, I haven't heard of anyone else in New Zealand having undergone that particular therapy. I know lots of gay people have been in therapies of one sort or another, but I haven't heard of anyone else in that. And it's only that I've tuned into its use overseas that has really encouraged me to sort of keep up a sort of academic interest. Still being used for alcoholism and gambling. I don't know what else. Paedophilia, I think they might be. The only other possibility, we talked about, you know, group therapy and psychotherapy and so forth. And I mean, some advocates also talk about chemical castration.
Do you think your research over the years has changed your view on what you went through?
No, only a certain resentment to Basil James, because he'd written the piece in the medical journal from 1962 is really a brag about what a wonderful thing this is. And of course, most of the research I've read since is all what a waste of time. I think I read somewhere, you know, the failure rate, I don't know how many cases, but the failure rate was something like 99%, which is exactly what I would expect. And I'm even, you know, surprised that there was a single person who with perhaps different motivation and different heterosexual experience might actually have been able to shift enough. So I resent Basil James a bit, really. But when people say, well, was it voluntary? Well, yes, it was. I said, yeah, it was explained to me fairly and squarely, and I said, I'll give it a go. So.
Whatever happened to Basil James?
I think last time I tuned in, he was some very senior health authority in Queensland. I think he went on to be director of mental health in New Zealand. And then last time I saw, he'd be getting on now because he was significantly older than me. So he'd be in his 80s now, I think.
And what are your thoughts now on the church asking you to undertake something like this?
It was reasonable. I don't think the church asked me to do the aversion therapy. The church asked me to address the problem. Can I make that distinction? The particular way in which I ended up addressing it was, I don't think the bishop, for example, would have the slightest idea that I'd even had aversion therapy. The parish priest certainly did. I mean, knew all about it. And he was just supporting me with it. But, I mean, all he was asking in the beginning was for me to talk to the student health psychiatrist about the issue. And I happened to strike Basil James, who had a bee in his bonnet about aversion therapy.
Do you have any final reflections on the therapy and you're going through it?
Only that... I thought it was medieval, I thought it was barbaric, I thought it was scientifically suspect. No, sorry, I now think it was all those things. Scientifically suspect, inexcusable, a major breach of human rights and medical ethics. And I would certainly never undergo it again, and I would be absolutely appalled and quite vocal if I ever learned that a younger person was being encouraged to undertake the same therapy.